concepts. But we'll see what the future brings. Wes, back to you. I think we have that attenuation problem again. Maybe you should try Echo Link, Wes.
My question is... hold on. Okay. So my question was, how can you use nano-DNA to serve as a spectrum analyzer, and I say sort of, and to achieve?
Okay, I don't exactly know how you're going to do that. The way that they work strikes me as different, but how would you plan to do that?
Okay, I ask both of you for your opinion, and I would be happy to both of you respond to that.
Again, I don't quite know how you would make it a spectrum analyzer. I make it a signal generator, yes, but I don't know how you'd make it a spectrum analyzer.
Oh, comment?
Sure.
Well, that's the point. I think, let me start from the beginning. I mean, the vector, the network analyzer is basically a signal source and a signal receiver that are sweeping along at the same frequency. The signal source is put out with a sweeping sine wave, and at the same time the input to the network analyzer will listen at that frequency and display its amplitude, either boost or attenuate of that signal, and compare to the phase of the original incoming signal. That's the vector part of it. So it's displaying amplitude and phase of what happens to this sweeping sine wave source that is run through some device under test. So the receiver portion of a network analyzer is essentially a swept receiver that is listening to the signal. But now the only difference between, I think, a true spectrum analyzer and the input to the vector network analyzer is the fact that a true spectrum analyzer allows you to put a variety of different internal filters in front of it. But as I was mentioning, you should be able to, depending on what kind of bandwidth you desire or anything, to use the input part of a network analyzer as a spectrum analyzer. It is essentially listening at the same frequency as the signal source of the network analyzer. Now I could be wrong on that, but I think, as I said, I've seen some older equipment which has been advertised as spectrum/network analyzer, because it's basically a spectrum analyzer with a tracking generator. Okay.
Like I said, I'm unfamiliar with this. I would assume there would be isolation problems and other problems that would limit the range and increase the cost as opposed to separate devices. but I guess where there's a will, there's a way. But still, you know, with VNA, you're injecting the signal, so you have a good idea of what the range of amplification you need to pick up the reflection and such. With a spectrum analyzer, it's a lot more woolly because you don't know what you're dealing with. You probably need extra amplification and low noise amplifiers and other such to kind of get it a decent amount of range. But I've never built any of these, so it's all just guesses on my part.
Well, actually, that was quite a good answer. Yes, you can use nanoVNA as a spectral analyzer, but instead of amplifiers, you need to put attenuators, because you're going to damage in a matter of seconds if you try to use it as a spectral analyzer. But there are people who use it, and they're here.
Okay,
so I spoke to two handmade amateurs. One was from Poland, the other one was from Ukraine, and both of them, because it's inexpensive, used nanoVNA as a spectrum analyzer as well. Although in Poland right now there is a plenty of equipment, available, and the level of income is quite close to the American one, so people rather decide to buy good quality equipment, because as I've heard, they say, I'm not rich enough to pay twice and to exchange.
Okay, I understand the attitude. When you're talking about calibration equipment, certainly. When you're talking about the high-end amateur radio equipment, possibly. You know, these things are $100. I mean, I don't want to sound like the ugly American, but I mean, if you got to kind of scratch your head for days on end to see if you could afford a gadget for $100. I don't know. It seems to be a little bit excessive, tight with the money personally, but, each to their own.
Okay, interesting. Another subject. Global G line uses a transmission line. This one is interesting because we spoke about the surface wave, and I do appreciate that to raise your skepticism. But actually, surface waves was used twice and was documented. So, if we talk about a G-line, G-line is a wire that has two cones on each side, and it allows you to send the signal or the power on it. And, of course, it is expected that the wire is covered with the Teflon. So you could use RG59 or RG58. Let's say take the jacket out, and now you are left with one wire that is coated with dielectric. And if you recall, K2RIW said that the wave is actually traveling not on a wire, and not outside of the wire. It is actually traveling in the space between the wire and the dielectric. Even though that for the eye doesn't look like it is any space, for electromagnetic waves, in TM mode, it is a highway. Let me jump. Okay. So, the simplest way of transmission language is according to the articles of ARRL, but it's become 2011 by two ham radio amateurs, scientists, N6GN and K6EGD in two instances. At first, as a feed line, the transmission line called SWTL, surface wave transmission line, using balloon aerial support for 2 meter antenna and transmitting significant power for supporting that high altitude antenna. Actually, they had a problem because there was a mountain between the two stations from the other side of that mountain. So what they did is they used 1/32nd of an inch, let's say gauge 26 wire, that wire was serving as a transmission line. However, they went a little bit further, and what they did is they used, instead of the wire that is coated with the dielectric, they used the bare wire that was coated with nothing, and it worked. Of course, they didn't mention that the air was acting as a dielectric, so now you had all of the conditions required by the waveguide to work. So they used that wire as a waveguide. So they lifted that balloon with 2 meter antenna at the end, with that wire connected as a transmission line to 260 feet elevation, and they presented on the video that I have sent you that it worked. On the same webpage that I sent you link for, they had also energy transfer for the distance of 300 feet with the light bulb serving as a load. So, let me drop. Okay, so, little bit of information. In 1950, George Kobau introduced a new surface wave transmission, SWTL, that required a single conductor. The line known since a G line required the electric insulation around the wire, or else special featuring of the conductor to slow the relative velocity of propagation in order to keep the signal from leaving the wire conductor. Reference books, including the ARRL VHF manual, provided information for Kobau work at 1974 QFT Article 2 by George Hetwell, K6LK, and there is more information about it. So, they decided instead of using coated wire, they used the bare wire, and they say that it worked pretty well, giving quite good signal, and that is noticeable on the video. Back to you for any comments. Enter G.
AC2GS. Well, we've kind of talked about this, and at least 70-80 times I've said that I believe in the concepts of plane waves. I just don't believe in lossless Zenik waves. And Gabau lines, they're fine. My gut feeling is that they don't strike me as something highly dependable day in and day out. They're an interesting experimental demonstration. I don't think they give you any kind of increased benefit of a transmission line. Again, I don't think it's lossless. I don't really believe in the violation of conservation of energy. So, they're a Galois line, and they work, and they're plane waves, and they exist. I just, again, don't believe in air quotes, Zenik waves, which is what most physicists tend to do when they mention Zenik. And that's all. The thing that I think you're kind of, you were promoting way back was that they were magically lossless. And again, I don't believe it. You can cite one experiment from a biased individual who was out to prove it, which is not the way science works. That wasn't corroborated with anyone else. But I don't believe it, and there's been no demonstration that warrants my belief. That's it.
No, I didn't get what you're understanding. I never claimed that it's lossless. What I said is the lower is the frequency, the lower is the losses. The closer you are to the Schumann frequency, 8.75 hertz, the lower the losses. That's what I said. And whether we name it Zenig wave, it's just one of the names in the group called surface wave. And the surface wave starts from gigahertz, from actually light frequency. And if we want to see an electromagnetic wave that is trapped in the waveguide, we could recall the fiber optic. And fiber optic is actually no reflection, no refraction. Interior reflection waveguide that is guiding electromagnetic waves from point A to point B and to X here.
Well, but those are reflections and refractions. So I'm at a loss to understand why you don't believe that the way light travels through fiber optic cables doesn't have anything to do with refraction and refractive reflection, you know, depending upon the incidence angles and such.
No, we're talking about the external reflection and the external refraction, and then we're talking about internal reflection. So yes, the electromagnetic wave in the fiber is internally reflected. Back to you.
Okay, I don't see how it could be externally. It's the glass with optical qualities, and there's an opaque sheath around it. So how would it possibly reflect and refract externally in a fiber optic, a fiber optic in general? Again, it's all internal. The structure is internal. The structure isn't external. It's actually covered up. It's sheathed.
Okay, so if we're talking about the electromagnetic wave bouncing from the opticals, that would be one bounce only. If it hit the fiber optic from outside, it would bounce out of it. So that would be just one-time interaction. Now we're talking about trapping electromagnetic wave in the waveguide. We may say that we could have a circular waveguide, rectangular waveguide, or the flat waveguide, or spherical waveguide. And as far as we know what is circular and rectangular waveguide, we may say that flat waveguide, which is like a pancake, is between the two media. One is usually conductive media or lossy conductive media, and the other one is dielectric. But of course, you can have a waveguide for higher frequencies, especially light waves, the electromagnetic waves, waveguide that is made from dielectric and dielectric, but both of those dielectrics have to have a different dielectric constant. So here in this antenna that used one wire only as acting as a feed line for the wire that was acting as a feed line or transmission line to the antenna that was lifted by the balloon, we had a waveguide that was made out of the burn wire and the air that was the dielectric. and they were able to match the impedance to the point that most of the signal, or all of the signal, was able to be delivered to the antenna and to XEO.
How did they know that all of the signal got out the antenna? I mean, trying to figure out the loss of an antenna system is very, 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 very difficult. You basically need an anechoic chamber, you need a lot of field stress meters, and you need a lot of time. So I don't quite, you know, I think what you really need is they got out and they heard the signal. They don't know if they got 100% of their transmitter power out the antenna, or 50%, or 20%, or 10%. They just know there was enough out getting out to make contact with people, which is a significantly different concept.
You're absolutely right. I can read the quote. In addition to providing very wide frequency information transmission system using existing power lines, SWTLS, are interesting as means of transmitting significant power for supporting high altitude antennas. That means they say, don't say that they didn't have a losses, but they have significant power that was delivered. A video demonstration of 40 dB improvement to channel capacity through the use of helium balloons aerostat supporting a lightweight wideband antenna fit with SWTL surface wave transmission line has already been shown. And they also gave the reference to the previous ARRL publications and other sources they used in construction, the feed line, and to achieve.
Okay, but I mean, I would interpret that differently. The relatively lightweight transmission line that they used didn't burn up from the power of the transmitter. Not that it got to the transmitter and out of the radiator. But simply that it didn't burn up the transmission line when they were alluding to high power. So I take a different interpretation than you.
That's okay. We can agree or disagree. And that's the whole sense of us being on this forum, because I can learn something from you. And definitely I expect from you not confirming what I'm saying, but criticizing what I'm saying, because if all of the people start to say yes, then we have a communism. And I went to the United States of America to escape from communism. People being one-sided. So I do appreciate every time when you criticize me and showing me where I'm possibly wrong or I'm possibly misunderstanding something, and to agree.
Okay, I mean, you know, we've been doing this for more than a few years. I still remember, I listened to the archives over at amateurradio.tv of a few years before I got my license. And sure enough, Dick was on the technical net with you and confusing you with another gentleman from Romania a bunch of times. And discussing about this. So you've been doing this longer than I've been doing this.
Well, the part of the art in this area was shared by me, and my English wasn't as good at the time. My knowledge wasn't as good at the time as it is now. And a part of it is intellectual property that I'm not obligated to keep to myself. So whatever I can, I will try to share with this nice forum of ham radio operators. So I do thank you very much for allowing me to discuss it, but I see the sources mentioned in the articles, of those two ham radio operators, and I see the results and the published videos as legit. You might see it different, and that's okay. And to next year.
Again, I'm not casting aspersions to those amateur radio operators. I'm taking my interpretation of the way that they mentioned that the full power was tolerated, as not meaning that it was radiated off of the antenna, but that it simply didn't burn up the transmission line. And I alluded to some other guys that I'm a little bit more suspicious of, again, who have a biased view and kind of did experiments by themselves, and they're unreproducible, and you know, everyone seems to go to their results. And you know, if we learned anything from cold fusion, it's that if you can't reproduce findings, those few findings that demonstrate weirdness are probably useless. But, you know, so those are different people than the two hams. I'm sure the two hams legitimately are playing around with caboo lines and, you know, let them have fun. Again, I don't think it's a practical means of transmission for most amateur radio operators who aren't tinkering. But, you know, who knows? Let them continue to tinker and see what they come up with.
Of course. And you actually said one good thing. You mentioned confusion. I don't believe that the confusion was a scam. I believe it was a mistake. And then after it was published, those two scientists were in a situation in which they had started to say the truth, and that put them into the situation in which they absolutely lost. Do you agree with that?
AC2GS. I think it started as a mistake. I think it started with them presenting their findings prematurely and not taking the proper measures to kind of double and triple check revolutionary new ideas that they really wanted to be special. So I think they made mistakes. I don't think it started as a grift to them. I think other people kind of climbed on board, and both political people and college, university people, and took it as far as they did as their own little grifts. So it's a complicated history lesson. But you know, there are proper ways of doing science, and there are improper ways. You have a perfect example only a couple of years ago of those damn room temperature superconductors that weren't. The research team, part of the research team snuck around and released their paper before it was finished. So, you know, half of them were proper scientists, and the other were goofy people or something. I don't know. So, I mean, you know, science always has people that try and bend the rules and, you know, make it, fake it until you make it type of nonsense. Again, it's a complicated thing, cold fusion, but its basis seems to be nonsense. Again, I don't blame them for the mistakes. I kind of blame them for the hard-headedness they presented to the world 20 years down the road, when they should have simply said, yeah, we goofed up, as opposed to, well, we didn't goof up, and we'll be releasing our findings any week now, which they never did.
Oh, of course. And to HGM, talking about the room temperature superconductor, as you said, if something cannot be repeated independently, most likely, it's not working. I'm not saying it's a scam. I'm not saying it's a joke. I'm saying it's not working. And not working could be their own mistake. and not necessarily the something that they wanted to do to fool people all around, because this kind of thing has too many people involved and too many people with knowledge. From the other hand, something cannot be replicated till it's patented, because people do not want to talk about it at all. Or if the information somehow leaks out, they want to rather stay silent. And other people seeing the pieces of information qualifies it as something that is not legitimate. Back to you.
Well, I tend not to agree. It's very difficult to keep a secret. It's very difficult to keep a secret for very long. So, you know, the excuse that some people give that, well, it wasn't reproduced because Big Oil bought it all up and hid it in a deep, dark hole, doesn't serve any purpose to science. So those are the excuses that are made for magic pills that make you live forever and pills that you put into your oil tank filled with water, and the pill dissolves and it turns it into petroleum fuel. And there's an infinite battery conspiracy that the battery companies paid people off. All the times that when people start to use the excuse of big business paid them off to kill the technology, that's not the way technology works. You can delay things a little bit, but you can't bury them. Nothing stays buried in my observations of the world. So, you know, if big business kind of needs to kind of get ahead of it for 5 or 6 or 10 years, maybe, if they throw enough money. There are people out there who legitimately think that the Earth is flat, and every single person who has anything to do with astronomy is being paid off. And I'd love to know the guy who has the deep pockets to pay off that many people. That must be a trillionaire.
Well, there are different behavior. There is a different behavior of different entities or people. So we cannot say yes. In 2011, when I was poisoned inside the plane, and at that time, John, KC2WGB, we agreed together that we're going to be in contact. Just because I wanted to see one guy in Georgia, in Europe, in Tbilisi, Georgia, in Europe. So somebody else, some Russian, I'm not saying all Russians, some Russian didn't like me just to visit the guy. And he decided to poison us all because we both met in Prague, in Czech Republic, and then we went to Tbilisi, Georgia. And I know who was it, because later on I was able to give that guy who did it, with the help of young couple from behind of it, and I was able to save myself just because I... force myself to throw everything, and I open up the door from the toilet and ask for water and water and water and more water and more water. And the steward told me, you are red on your face. So it is not like giving that, well, nobody's going to do anything wrong to you. And to XGM.
Wesley, you know, I'm glad you survived it. I'm sorry you suffered it. It's not any kind of proof that anything underlying was there. So I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't have a clue. But you can't kind of invoke that as any kind of proof that you're violating the law of conservation of energy. I know you're going to tell me that you're not. You're simply moving energy that we don't have access to this week around, but it still sounds like a violation of conservation of energy to me.
Well, entering here. There is no violation of conservation of energy possible. So if somebody says that he can, it's mostly something that is somebody believe, or somebody joke, or somebody scam. You cannot have energy from nothing. You cannot have sending energy from point A to point B without the losses. You can minimize the losses, but you cannot completely, 100%, send energy from one point to the other without the losses. And into a sphere.
Okay, so we agree on that. The little details, probably not. But I don't think we should kind of circle the rabbit hole here. Maybe you should kind of move on to your next subject.
Okay, the next subject is asteroid 2004 YR4, year 4. And if it's possible, if Paul could help us in it. So the asteroid is heading the Earth, but actually the percentage of that asteroid to hit the Earth is small. It is small now because it's far away. But the orbit, elliptical orbit of that asteroid is actually crossing the orbit of the Earth. So there is a probability that those two may actually collide. But then, from the other hand, talking over the size, which is about 50 to 100 meters, it is not something that could be that tragic as it was the meteor that hit the Earth, causing dinosaurs to die. So if Paul would be able to comment on it, I would appreciate, and to assure him.
WS2N. Yeah, hi, Wes. I read about it. You know, it is in a highly elliptical orbit. I think it goes out a couple of AU, astronomical units. From the sun, and then it goes in near the sun. So yeah, there's a lot of those asteroids that do that. You know, it's not the only one. And they came up with a percentage of YR4 hitting the Earth. They said 1 in 100 chance was 1 in 100. And then they just updated the information, and now it's, you know, 2 in 100. And so it's one out of 50 possibility of the thing hitting the Earth. And it wouldn't be until, you know, like next decade or something. So I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. It's just another, you know, asteroid. I think a couple hundred feet, I think 300 or 400 feet in diameter. So it's not going to be. It's not going to wipe out a planet. They said if it hit a city, if the thing hit London, it would just be a major problem. But any asteroid coming into the atmosphere, big or small, you know, you have a very very small chance of actually hitting land. You know, mostly water. But chance mostly it would hit water. But yeah, I mean, they discovered this thing with the Euclid, the European Space Agency telescope. You know, it's out there about a million miles. Oh, correction, I think that's another story that has to do with the. And that had to do with the Einstein story I read. I'm putting the two stories together. Okay, yeah. Anyway, back to you. That's pretty much all I know about YR4. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, so let's see. So if we convert meters to feet, it's 300 feet. The maximum diameter of that asteroid, 2024YR4, is 200 feet. It is difficult to really say how big it is because it's not a ball. The size of it, the shape of it, is not something that would be able to be measured from that distance. But anyhow, there was a suggestion, instead of sending a nuke to it, which if we look at the sun, Tunguska's asteroid that hit Earth in 1910 or 1908 was right about the size or just a little bigger. And a few thousand of miles of the forest in Siberia was actually blown around the place of impact. So even if that asteroid hit the Earth, we're not expecting a bigger problem unless it hits one of the major cities. So there was a suggestion to send the engines, instead of blowing it with the nuke, send the engines. This way we change the trajectory of that asteroid, avoiding the collision, or if it's not that asteroid, any asteroid that we are able to redirect. And if you remember, there was an experiment with the impact of the man-made spacecraft with the asteroid, just to prove that it works. Could you say a few words about it, Paul? And to a G.
Okay. And by the way, this thing, I just looked it up, was discovered by Atlas, the telescope in Chile, one of the telescopes in Chile. And, the DART mission a couple of years ago, that mission, what they did was they found an asteroid that was actually two asteroids, so one small one orbiting a little larger one. So what they wanted to do, they wanted to see if they could influence the trajectory of both of them as they head toward the sun. And the way they did it is they hit the smaller one. The idea was to change the relative speed of the smaller one going around the larger one. So it changes the timing. You know, it now takes a lot longer for this little asteroid to go around the larger one. And by doing it, it changes the gravitational pull on the larger one. You know, because it's slightly elliptical. So it changes the angle of where it's, where the gravitational pull is stronger. By doing that, it actually pulls the larger one way or the other. So that only will really help with when you have two asteroids, one orbiting the other one. It's not going to help if you have one single one heading this way. You know, if you hit it with what they hit it with, that would be like, you know, a flea hitting an elephant on the tropics. That's not going to really do anything if it's a larger asteroid. So I think you said hooked, put engines to it. Yeah, well, I guess that's been theorized. You know, actually, you know, land something there and then fly the engines, and maybe something will move. And if they do it early on, you know, maybe a year or two, or you know, before it ever comes near the Earth, they might have a chance of just changing the trajectory just that little bit, where it's going to miss Earth. So that's one possibility. The Trzaskin, I think it was Trzaskin location in Russia, in Siberia. That was, 1908. Let me drop it. Yeah, that was a famous impact. You know, it took them years to study it, because back then they didn't have satellites, they didn't have, you know, easy way to get to this place. It was in the middle of nowhere, in the woods of Siberia. But there was a town nearby, and they got reports from those Russians. And there was trees knocked down in all kinds of different directions. And they determined that this asteroid that eventually hit, well, that's the problem, it never really hit. It actually exploded above the Earth, you know, maybe, you know, hundreds of feet above the Earth, maybe half a mile, whatever it was. Never actually hit the Earth, but by exploding like that, that's what caused all the damage. You can imagine what would have happened if the thing held together. Anyway, back to you, WS Slam.
Okay, I'm pretty sure. Because I have you right now, Kenji, there is another subject I would like to discuss. I would appreciate you give us the information about it. So, the SpaceX did something unusual with Falcon 9 booster drone ships. So, usually that engine part was landing on the platform, or it could land on the special platform on the land or the south world. So I'm not sure. Did you, Paul, mention about flooding the landing platform with the south water for the 33 engines during the landing at sea, where the water is cooling down the platform and protects it from damage caused by heat and force? That's one question. And the second question, if let's say that module returning from space is not exactly at that platform, but a little bit left, a little bit right, is that module able to just go left or right to reach the point of landing exactly in a circle? Back to you.
I'm not sure what you're talking about with the module. We'll have to go over that. The deluge system, you know, that was introduced really big time for the shuttle. When the first shuttle went off, there was a lot of damage. So they introduced the system of, you know, a real deluge system with not salt water, regular water, for the shuttle system. And it, you know, that became commonplace. Russia does not do that. You know, they just launch from Baikonur, and there's a big enough space underneath the platforms where they don't need that. They don't use that. But we do. And then, of course, any of the large flights that are going to be taking off have that, including the new one, New Glenn. They had a big deluge system that worked just fine. And what you're talking about is putting the similar deluge system on a landing platform. I'm sure Blue Origin will probably do that in the future as well. It just cuts back on a wear and tear of the landing platform. You know, the landing platforms are reusable as well, so they don't want to damage them. So that's just an addition to, you know, what they've been doing. They've landed hundreds of these things. They're coming close to 400 of these things on these platforms. And the platforms are holding up just fine. But they just want them to last longer. And they're going to use clear water, not salt water. Salt water damages everything. They want to do that. So, yeah, it's just another step in the right direction to preserve everything. You don't need a big deluge system like you have with, you know, when you launch a rocket with 33 engines. You know, you need like millions of gallons of, you know, to do that. Out on a platform, you only have the one engine coming down. That's all they have. You know, when they come down close to the platform, that's it, one engine. That's really not, you know, they don't need to have gigantic tanks and all to do that. Back to you, Wes.
Okay. Enter Shane. Yeah, when I was using the word module, I meant 33 engines part of the rocket that is returning from the space and landing on the platform. As far as the sea water or regular water, well, on the landing platform, we do not have enough of reservoir for the regular water, and the rocket is made from stainless steel, and of course it is damaging, but I wanted to make sure that I understood the information properly. Back to you.
Yeah, well, on the ones that are coming back that are going to be landing, that they're going to catch, it's probably a couple hundred feet off the ground. They won't have to worry about that. They won't need a deluge system on that system. Maybe you could cool down the tower. They might need that. But, you know, we'll see. You were talking about the first stage coming back. Okay, I think you were talking about a completely different topic. You know, you said module coming back. I thought maybe something from outer space. Some kind of vehicle with a heat shield or something. But okay, you're talking about the first stage. And it's going to become more and more commonplace in the future. We're all with all these companies. Rocket Lab is building a company called rocket called Neutron. That's going to be also reusable, most likely landing on a drone ship in the beginning. And, but yeah, it's going to be the new thing. Relativity. 2026. They're going to be their first launch of their big vehicle, the heaviest. Medium to heavy lift vehicle. Also planned on being reusable. Anyway, we'll see how the future looks. Right now it's a little shaky in the space world because of what's going on with the government. So back to you, West WS.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Actually I use coming from the space. It's coming from the upper part of atmosphere. So every time there is a launch of the rocket, part of it with those 33 engines is coming back. So that was what I used the word module part of the rocket that is coming back. Okay, thank you. I have no more subjects to discuss. Dr. Roy, enter here.
And once you know, those 33 engines are not split coming back. You know, that they use 13. eventually 13 coming through the atmosphere and all. And then, you know, toward the end, I believe it's just the three engines that they're using at the very end.
Okay, thank you very much for that information. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS, thank you, Wes, as always. Thank you for your participation in the technical net. We do appreciate it. And look forward to next week's list. I am AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're still open for business. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments for tonight, please hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
Hey, Roy, you put some kind of an amplifier on there. All of a sudden, you're very loud.
Yeah, I'm trying out a new thing. Oh, a little too loud. Well, let me set it a little bit lower. Let's see how that is. Oh, geez. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, gosh. Really? Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now it's a little too low. Okay, how's that? Okay, yeah, I just kind of kicked in a level setting for my transmissions. Does it sound reasonable, or is it too loud, or strange in any other way?
So right now you're good. Maybe I would go up just one number, just one, just a touch more. But yeah, when you first came back, it blew out my speaker. Okay, I'm not sure. What do you have, a mic gain in there somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things going on. It's all through the computer. It's all stuck. So with the mixer that I'm using, there are limiters, there are anti-hiss, there's voice adjustment for background noise. So I thought I would turn the level up, because usually I'm looking at the waveform when I talk, and it always seems to be a little on the small side. So I thought I would kick it up a little bit, but this is a little too much of a good thing. So, okay, I hope I got the good level right now.
Yeah, it's great. Wonderful. Right now, that's the right setting. I don't have All-Star. Yeah, have you ever listened to, on a regular rig and All-Star at the same time? Is there a delay, or are you hearing it exactly at the same time?
No, there's a delay. I don't think it's a consistent one. It sort of depends upon how people are routing the local communications through All-Star. Sometimes it's just as simple as that, but other times they're taking a signal off of Echolink or something else. So it depends upon how many loops there are. It's nowhere as bad as my audio stream is. I use IceCast. That can have something like a 20-second delay. But it's kind of similar to Echolink.
Oh, okay. And your audio level is just great. Wonderful. Back to you, Roy, WS20.
Okay, I got to remember. I got to put a little tick there on the knob to let me remember where I planted it on. Anyway, this continues to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limark Technical Net. As I said before, we're still open for business. I hope the louder voice helps wake someone up in the back there. And, I got a question. I got a comment. I got a topic. And we'll go over to the radio and hit that push to talk. So, we still got 15 minutes for this segment if you want to use it. If you don't, we'll move on to something else. But I'll give you the chance. If anyone out there has any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk. Gosh, a bit of a tough audience tonight. Maybe it's President's Day weekend that's doing it. I don't know. I'll give you one more chance. If anyone has any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk.
WS2N. By the way, Roy, I'm coming.